Okay, this is tape 4, still June 22, 1994, a continuation, Gabrielle Denman interviewing Dr. Alan Melzer, and Mary Harrison will continue to write, transcribe. Dr. Melzer, we were on talking about Bruce's second summer in Moscow.
Eric,
Eric's second summer.
Invited being back.
Right.
Tell us one sentence so we can check to see if the tape's okay.
All right. One sentence so we can check to see if the tape is okay.
Good. Right.
So I did forget to say that it's Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women Oral History 2. Okay, now let's talk about Eric's second summer in Moscow.
Well, Eric was pretty good in Russian, and so the university, I'm pretty sure it's Michigan, invited him back. They had a local person from Intourist or one of the Russian agencies who took care of the planning and what they did while they were there, but they also needed somebody to coordinate with the Intourist group, and so they had an American student who did that, and they chose Eric to do that and as one of the guides. And so the next year was 1980. That was the year that Jimmy Carter kept the Americans from going to the Olympics, so relations between the Russians and the Americans were very frosty at that time. And that year they didn't go to Moscow. They went to Leningrad, and I think they went down to the Black Sea, so he got to see more of the country. And it was because Moscow was going to be crowded, and anyway, the relationships were not very good. And he noticed that in the way in which, in the problems that they had with the police and border guards and all that. Anyway, Eric had a very good time and learned a lot of Russian. So after he had finished his 4 years in college, he decided he wanted to take a year off, and there was a famous Russian book that had never been translated, and he decided he was going to translate it from Russian into English with some help reading his manuscript by one of his professors at Rochester. So he stayed at Rochester, worked on a research project with somebody in the economics or business school, in the business school, to support himself, and then worked on the translation of his book. And he got quite a bit of it translated in the year, and and the translation was still rough and needed a lot of polishing. And this book was printed by a man, it was written by a man named Herzen, H-E-R-Z-E-N. And Herzen had asked the question, what is to be done? And when Lenin came in, Herzen was an early socialist, when Lenin came in, he responded to Herzen's question directly, what is to be done? So it was a historically important book, and Herzen was an early Russian socialist. Well, it turned out that although the book had not been translated for over 100 years, suddenly some professor came out with a translation just at the time Eric was working on it. So I think the Moscow State Publishing or somebody brought out a copy of an English translation of Herzen's book. So that was the end of Eric's connection with that book. I suppose he probably still has his notes somewhere. So he went to work, and he went to Washington, and he got a job at the National Taxpayers Union as a gopher. Pretty soon, he was publishing their newsletter, and shortly after that, they set up a private foundation, and I think he was all of 22, to raise money and support some of their activities, studies, and all that research thing, because they were a lobbying organization, but they set up a foundation to build, to do nonpartisan studies on issues that they were concerned with, and he became the head of that foundation and raised some money, and organized a board of directors and so on, and anyway, did that for a while. Then moved to New York and worked as a fundraiser for something called the Manhattan Institute that published published George Gilder's book that was so well known, published a book by Charles Murray on the welfare system, and that's very well known, and it's been a successful think tank. Anyway, Eric went to work for them as their fundraiser and did that for about another year and a half, and then went back to graduate school at the University of Chicago to get an MBA.
Gilder's book, you say, is so very well known.
Yes.
Could you tell us the title?
I can't tell you the title, but it was a book that about growth and in the U.S. And it was a book that President Reagan singled out when he first came into office, just about that time, as a book that everybody should read, so the book got a big sale at the had to do with tax cuts and growth and all that in the U.S. economy. But I can't remember the name.
That's okay. Now, Eric is still in Chicago?
No, Eric finished at the University of Chicago and took a job first at Chemical Bank and doing investment banking. And then they cut out his division, so he was unemployed for quite a long time and had to sort of stumble around on his own. He was married at that point. His wife was very supportive, but he worked hard at lots of different things trying to get started. And then he got a job as an investment banker at a company called Brenner Securities, and he's now a vice president at Brenner Securities, and he's working in telecommunications. So he's very busy. Whenever I want him at 10 o'clock at night, I call him at his office because that's where I'm almost certain to find him. And the other day I called him and he wasn't there, so I called him the next morning and said, "Eric, you're a slacker. It was 11 o'clock and you were gone."
Is he living in Chicago?
No, he lives in New York. Outside of New York. He's married. His wife, Anne, is a psychologist who works for the Board of Medical Examiners in Philadelphia. They live near Metro Park, which is a major railroad station in New Jersey, and she takes a train to Philadelphia and he goes to New York.
Do they have children?
They have one.
How?
Little boy, be two in just a couple of weeks.
What's his
Scott.
Name?
Scott.
Okay. Does Bruce have children?
Bruce has two children.
Yeah.
He has two girls. They're 5 and 3, named Avery and Sophie.
I like those names. And what's Bruce's wife's name?
Bruce's wife's name is Nancy Cooper.
Okay, and is she working?
Yes, she works. She runs a foundation that takes care of the homeless. And she buys houses, remodels them, gets money to remodel them, and then moves in indigent families. She's now on her second house, I think, or third house.
And that's in Boston?
Yeah, in the Boston area.
In Boston, okay. Now tell us about your princess.
Right. Beth went to Erlin after she finished Winchester. She went for 2 years and took a year off, worked around the university for a little while, and so we used to walk to work together occasionally.
Oh, here at this university?
This university.
Isn't Erlin similar to Antioch in this work?
Erlin is more like it's a Quaker school.
I see.
And in a very nice little college. But anyway, one of these days she told me that if I wasn't her father, she would leave Erlin and do something else. And I said, "Well, you know, what does my being your father have to do with anything?" So she said, "Well, what is it that you wanted to do?" So she said, "What she really wanted to do was to be a baker." So I said, "Well, you know, why are you working at the university? Get yourself a job being a baker and see whether you really like doing that. I mean, this is a great time for you to do that." Well, she didn't quite do that, but she went to, she got a job being a chef, a sous chef in a restaurant up on Mount Washington.
Do you know which one? Do you remember?
I can't remember. It's one of the smaller ones, not one of the bigger ones. It was just a chef. And she had a very good chef that she worked with, and I think she learned a lot. And she loved it. I mean, the summer was hot, almost as hot as it's been in the last couple of days. She was working in that oven, and she's a tiny little thing. She would just be so happy that she'd come out of work at 11 o'clock or something. You know, she just enjoyed it so much. So she worked there for about 6 months, and then she went to the Culinary Institute in Hyde Park, New York, and got some real training to be a chef, and came back to Pittsburgh. She was, and got married, to John O'Brien, and she's the mother of two children. She worked as a chef briefly when she came back, but that her husband worked early morning, started at early morning. Of course, being a chef, she had to work nights and weekends. So she then worked in a retirement community and eventually started her own catering business, which she did until her children started to come. And she now has two children. Jamie, who will be 7 in September, and Kate, who is 5. And she has started a new business now, about a little over a year ago. Yeah, about a year and a half ago, called Just Desserts. She makes cakes and muffins and scones and various things for restaurants and coffee shops.
Oh, That's here in Pittsburgh.
Here in Pittsburgh, and she now has, as of now, I think she has about 3.5 employees, and her business is growing pretty regularly, and she works very hard at it. I mean, okay. It's a 7-day-a-week business. She has a hard time going on family vacations or coming to Thanksgiving dinner because those days are busy days for her.
Does she ever bring some of her goodies to you?
Yes, once in a while, but not very often. Fortunately, not very often because I don't need all those things.
So that brings us up to date.
That brings us all to date on all the children, okay. Right? So we have 5 grandchildren, and I suppose the one additional thing we should say is we think it's very important for them, for the cousins, to know each other. So what we've tried to do is to plan a way in which that happens. One of the ways to do that is we get together on holidays like most families, but 2 days doesn't seem to be enough. So we started last year to have a family vacation. We take them all to one place where the children and grandchildren can play together and get to know each other. And I think that's the first year was very successful, and we're about to have the second year in August.
Right. Where did you go the first?
We go to Eaglesmere. We'll go to Eaglesmere again in eastern Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. That's a place where, given the location, we all can get together, and it's a very nice place for children.
Sounds wonderful. Mm-hmm. May I ask you one more thing? What's Marilyn doing these days?
Well, Marilyn had a very successful career as a weaver. She was there's an international weaving show in Lausanne, Switzerland, where people compete from all over the world. She's been in that twice. She's done a lot of weaving. She sold for. It's really not weaving so much as it developed into off-loom sculpture. And so she did
wall hangings
and some things which stand independently. And she's done some things which she invariably would win best in show when she would show in Pittsburgh. And she was really quite successful, and she had a pretty good career. And about 2 years ago, I guess, thereabouts, she decided she was in the International in Lausanne for the second time. She had a very good piece which toured in Europe at various museums. And she decided that was a good time to quit. And so she's given that up and given up her studio in the design center and has gone into counseling. So she works for battered women and one day a week, and mothers who are having problems with their children another day a week. And she does runs group therapy exercises.
Has she been trained in that area?
She's trained herself.
I see. Okay. Shall we stop
here? She reads a lot and has gone to lectures, and she's gotten training. She's quite good at it.
Oh, sure. That's interesting. Okay. I think we're continuing with Dr. Alan Meltzer. Today is the 29th of July. It's Gabby Dinman taking notes. It's Mary Harrison interviewing. It's tape 4, the middle of side 7. One moment. Hi, Dr. Meltzer. I think we are fine. Where we stopped the last time, your suggestion was, and it's a very good one because I reviewed the tape, and now it's time for you to tell us what you're doing, what you are doing now, and.
Well, there have been three or four strands to my research over my lifetime, and as I get to the age that I'm now in, I'm pulling them all together and finishing up whatever I'm going to do about them. So one of those areas was studies of money and credit and their role in the economy. At one time, I thought that Bruner and I would write a fairly extensive book to bring together the many papers that we had written. We didn't quite do that. What we did do was give a series of lectures in Italy, sponsored by somebody called the Mattioli Foundation. That second area of my interest has been work on political economy, trying to bring together political institutions with economics. Economists worry about efficiency and how economies operate and what are ways of getting or increasing efficiency, which is, of course, the source of most productivity gain and gains in real income. So So that's a major thrust of what economics is about. Now, political process, in my observation, has always been is much more about redistribution, who gains and who loses. Politicians aren't so much interested in efficiency. They're not against it, but they're interested. They're much more interested in who pays and who receives. And so I've tried to bring together with some co-authors, particularly my former colleague here, Scott Richard, and a friend who's visited him many times from Israel named Alex Kukerman. We've tried to bring together some of these issues and work them out, and I've put all those papers together in a book called Political Economy. So that's a second string, and I think while I may do a little more in that area, I certainly don't intend to do to go back to it in a serious way. A third area was that I worked on for many years was to write a book about, just because I was interested in it because it was so important for economics, a man named Keynes, who's dominated much of the thinking about economics for a long time, either because people were trying to follow up his ideas or because people were opposing them. Anyway, I really worked to read all of just about all of his papers and to put out an interpretation of my own interpretation of that, and I finished that, and that was a major activity. And now I think I'm on the last probably of these activities, and that would be what I hope to do in the next year, at least to make a big quantum movement in the next year. I have been very interested through much of my life in actual economic policy, particularly in monetary policy and the role of the Federal Reserve. I've written a lot on that subject, and I'm now going to bring that all together in a history of the Federal Reserve. So I'm going to have an analytic history of the Federal Reserve in the next 4 months in Boston. I hope to get a lot of that written. So those are the four main things. And when I finish those, and I think I look forward to that at this point. When I finish those, there are other things that I would like to begin to think about. One of them is foreign policy. I'm very interested in foreign policy, and I think that the principles that I've learned about economic policy carry over with some adaptation into foreign policy. So if I go anywhere after I finish my history of the Federal Reserve, it will be to think about foreign policy. I've already written two papers and published one, sort of beginning to put out some of my ideas about foreign policy, and I think I'll try to follow up on that a little bit more.
How old is the Federal Reserve?
Started in 1914.
And
it was passed by Congress December 28, 1913.
Okay, your interest in foreign policy, is that still in relationship to the economy?
Because there are certain principles that we've learned in economic policy. For example, when we think about economic policy, economists think about something called a public good. And that doesn't mean to us what it quite means to you. It means that that if we organize a community, it's a very old idea. In fact, it goes all the way back to John Locke and David Hume. I mean, the idea in its simplest form is if we organize a community, if we're living in a community, there are certain things which we can do collectively which can be done better collectively than they can be done by individuals. There's certain benefits of having the collective do things that individuals can't do. So we're never going to have a complete free enterprise market economy in which everybody takes care of himself. There are always going to be some things which have to be done collectively. And to show what those things are, those things are called public goods. Now, what are they? Well, the example that John Locke used was police protection. If you have a house and you want to hire a guard, the guard is standing there. He can look at the next house, the neighbor's house, and the neighbor can free ride on your guard. He can say to the guard, look, while you're watching your house, Mary's house, he can also watch Gabby's house, and I'll pay you just a little bit extra if you just keep your eye on my property too. So there's obviously some advantage in having this thing provided, having the police provided communally. And of course, the defense is the major form of these public goods. It's why the Constitution of the United States doesn't allow people to say, I'm not going to pay taxes for defense, I only want my money to go there, because that would violate the whole idea of a public good, and it would create what is to be worried about in this case, free riders, people who would say, well, even though I benefit from this, I can just say I'm going to opt out of this and refuse to pay because they can't defend everybody else without me. Now, let me give you an application of that in the modern society. If you think about the defense of Western Europe, see, we paid the largest share of that defense, much more than the Europeans did. Why? Well, because each one of them would say, look, I cannot defend myself, right? Only I can only do this if the Americans do it. And how much the Americans spend, whatever I spend is not going to make very much difference compared to what they spend. So in any such group, there's always going to be wrangling about who's going to pay the shares and what shares they're going to be, because we have exactly the problem of the public good, which is the common defense, and the free riders, the fact that the Danes, for example, can say, or the Dutch can say, we're such a small country, what difference does it make whether we contribute or we don't contribute? The Americans are going to do what they're going to do, and it's going to work if they do it, it's not going to work if they don't do it. So, but of course, from the American standpoint, we're interested in seeing them all participate, contribute, because that lowers the cost to us and it brings them into some cooperative arrangement. Well, that's one economic principle. It's the principle of public goods. And it's a very important principle in thinking about what should be America's role in the world. Right? So that's one principle. Then there's also the principle, which is much more recent, called the principle of time consistency. That is basically of doing what it is that you promise to do and not promising to do things that you aren't able to do, because then you destroy your credibility, and there's a large literature in economics on the importance of credibility. Now, many of these things have been worked out in relation to budget policy or economic policy, but they're very applicable to foreign policy. So my colleagues and I, one of my colleagues and I, would like to take those issues and put them together with other things, like the importance of property rights, and make out of that the beginnings of a theory of foreign policy. So that's an ambitious undertaking, and I don't know how far we'll get in it, but anyway, that's the direction in which I would probably move once I finish the history of the Federal Reserve. So I'll take the skills that I have and try to apply them in a different problem, and of course, in the process, learn something about that problem, which will modify what I think, standing outside, what I think is important.
Would you still do it just with the colleagues that you feel have you have a mutual interest, or would you possibly consult for another agency? Or
no, I would do it here.
Here,
and
okay.
With colleagues, not necessarily colleagues here, but in this case, it is a colleague who is here.
Okay,
that is someone who brings knowledge and skills to the problem that where I can learn some of the things that he knows about that problem, and like any good collaboration, each one of us brings differences to it that we can bring together, and therefore do a better job of thinking about capturing the important aspects of the problem and recognizing what those important aspects are.
Now, public goods, where did that come from?
Came from the idea of John Locke, thinking about what was called the night watchman. That is, in just the example that I gave you,
okay,
about watching your house. And so he originally came up with the idea several hundred years ago about public goods. But when economists think about public policy, one of the ways they think about it is they think, well, what is it that the government or some outside agency is going to bring to this problem that individuals cannot do by themselves, right? That it's going to pay for the cost of organizing this new agency. What is it that they can do? After all, one of the ways we have for solving problems, the one that economists are most familiar with and talk about the most, is the market, right? Markets operate by individual effort. They don't require anybody to plan how they're going to be. If you want to open a store, you open a store. If you want to have a tourist agency, you open a tourist agency. If you want to go into business doing something, you do that, and you, in a sense, the organization is provided through the market mechanism, right? You post some prices and people come or they don't come.
But you have to have permission, actually, don't you, to open it? To open a store, or don't you?
You may have to get a license.
Right,
or something like
right,
that,
okay.
I mean, no one can tell you that beyond the zoning laws, that if you want to have a grocery store here or a restaurant there, that's your choice.
Okay.
So we have this marvelous, efficient way of organizing the use of resources and providing for the daily bread, clothing, transportation, entertainment, which nobody plans. That is, no agency ever plans that. It all gets organized by the actions of individuals saying, well, I think this is a good idea, I'm going to try it, and if it works, you know, I'm going to profit from it. And that way we get provided with most of the services that we have. So that's one way of organizing resources. It doesn't require any central planning to do that. There are other tasks, these public goods kind of tasks, which do require some kind of collective activity.
So you sound very optimistic that the system is working.
Well, the system isn't perfect, I mean, because we're people and we're not perfect, but the system works. It always has things that could be improved, and much of the discussion is whether it's improved much of the serious discussion, whether we were improved better by removing some of the restrictions that we now have or by putting on new laws and restrictions. Oftentimes, I mean, the most obvious example is Eastern Europe. The great improvements are going to come and are coming because we're removing restrictions and allowing people to make the kinds of choices through the marketplace which previously were done by central planners. The great lesson of the Russian and Eastern European society is that no central planner can efficiently do what private markets can do. Now that's surprising to people. It's a really surprising thing to people because they say, look, you have all these what used to be called the wastes of competition, right? You have each store deciding that it's going to stock more cans of tomato sauce, right? And one of them is going to have too many, right? And that's a waste of competition. Well, offsetting those so-called wastes are the enormous gains that come from having all these individuals planning themselves, searching around, looking for opportunities to improve themselves, to improve their lives, and in the process, of course, recognizing that in order to do that, they have to give you better service or more service or stay open longer hours and so on.
It's called competition.
It's called competition, yeah, right. Yeah. It's competition. And you see, and where socialists always saw competition as wasteful, what the lesson of the last 40 years has been is, far from being wasteful, it's the most dynamic, progressive, forceful way of efficiently getting people's goods and services that they want and finding new ones. I mean, look at the scramble which goes on to try by people in businesses spending hundreds of millions or billions of dollars to improve the telecommunication system for the public, because they realize that if they're there first with the best, they will capture the gains that come from that.
Do you think that the motivation is there in a country like Russia, such a vast...
Oh, yes.
You do?
Yes,
you think yes. Even though
I think this is a human trait.
You do? Okay.
But a human trait which depends very much upon the institutions in which you live. I mean, it can be suppressed. But once you take away the restrictions that is making it a crime, for example, to make money, once you take away those, there are going to be lots of people who are going to have the same kinds of motivations that we find here. After all, like every other country, Russia sent people here, right? Those people succeeded in a capitalist society. Many of them became wealthy. There's no reason why the ones they left behind should be any different. Once the rules of the game change so that they can...
How long do you think this will take?
Well,
in Russia?
Happening now. I mean, I'm told that more than half of the people in Russia now work in private firms. Right? And in Poland, for example, it's somewhere up around 70% of the people now work in private firms. The Polish economy is only 5 years from the time of the reform, is now beginning to boom. I mean, so we see this now. How long will it take before they catch up to us? That'll take a generation or more. Maybe never.
Yeah.
But I mean, but it will take a long time for... The rule of thumb that economists have is that if you're at a living standard, let's say of $30,000 a year, the average, close to the average in the U.S., and the Russians are at a living standard of $5,000 a year, that they'll make up 2% of the difference every year, right? So that if we grow and they grow every year, they'll catch up a little bit, but they'll only be making up about 2% of the difference. So it will take 20, 30, or 40 years before they actually would catch up to us. Of course, we're moving all the time.
Did you consult, or did Bob Strauss, when I remember he went to Russia, did you have anything to do with that visit at all, or what was your impression?
Very little. I had nothing to do with his going to Russia. I have been to Russia, and I talked to people there, and I've talked to some of the people from the Russian government here, but I've not been heavily involved in Russia. I've not been... very supportive of the way in which they've gone about reforming the Russian economy, and I've written a few newspaper articles.
Well, that's what interests me, because you sound optimistic, and that's not what I'm hearing from the news. And
well, I think the news is probably misleading at this point. I mean, Russia has a lot of problems. It has crime and so on. I thought that what needed to be done is you needed first to put in laws having to do with contracts, bankruptcy, private property rights, and so on, before you could really make the economy work well. And I think that it was a mistake not to do that. And it didn't mean that it wouldn't make improvements, but it meant that it was going to be a harder task and would work less well than if you put in place some of these laws and institutions which are required to, which we take for granted in our own system.
You talked about property rights. Is that applicable more in Eastern Europe, first I'd like you to comment whether that is an issue here in the United States today.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, I'd like you to please, and then also take it over to Europe, especially to Eastern Germany.
Let's take an example from our own. Suppose that you bought, and this is in fact the case, suppose you bought a house along the beach, and now they come